This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I fell down the rabbit hole when I was 44, right after the election.
I think we discovered those tunnels pretty much right when we first moved to that city. And
I no longer have blue eyes. I have big, beautiful brown ones now.
There was a cross directions too. And then there was the rats.
It was a large rabbit in a uniform.
So then you had to be very careful because they didn't like to be cornered.
For me, certain things are more of an adventure. Going rappelling or diving or, going mountaineering.
I'm another pedestrian on the sidewalk, walking, flying with her early. It's awesome.
This could be an amazing experience.
I know that that's pushing my personal limits.
And pushing our personal limits for the 31st consecutive month on public radio. Hello, welcome. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller from our sumptuous closet studio in Sebastopol, California. Four stories today, so we won't run our mouths a whole lot in between.
If you're a new listener, hitchhiking is not about hitchhiking, but we are about journeys and life journeys, where there is always that element of risk and the unknown and this strange need for trust. And none of these are very popular ideas today, I admit, unless you are in the realm of high finance, in the world of our new action heroes courageously risking other people's money and other people's lives.
Today, stories about the dark. So what is the dark?
Anywhere, I think, where you are not really sure what's in front of your nose. And so we're going to go into the world of the blind, and literally into the underworld, and metaphorically down the rabbit hole.
First story, storm sewers.
Thomas Nash lives in Sebastopol, and earlier in this series we talked with him as part of our War Veterans show. Recently we asked on the website for stories about journeys into the dark, and so we talked with him about his adventures at the age of 13 in the storm drains under the city of Oakland.
Well, it was right at a little creek that was right next to our elementary school playground. And if you walked over a little teeny fence and squeezed through and climbed down this slippery path, there was the entranceway there with a nice little pristine creek and little country setting with big oak trees and like an untouched little, really nice little area. And these tunnels would go for, maybe a mile or so. Then they would open up sometimes and they would go basically east and west down to the bay, and some of them would branch off north and south. You had to be very careful because sometimes there would be rebar sticking out from the sides, and depending what time of the year it was, how high the water would be running through them, you had to be very careful when the rain had been coming in, not slip into the water. And sometimes people would run their rafts, little inner tubes down there, but it was very dangerous, with a number of children dying sometimes trying to do that. But it became a nice place to be that was cool in the summer, and it was also a place that was private and was our own little world. My brother, who was 3 years younger than me, and my best friend and teacher, and myself, and numerous friends that we would bring into the tunnels, and sometimes it would be their first time and it would be initiation. And then there was a couple more of us that would routinely do our little jaunts into the nighttime and into the tunnels and sometimes other locations too. The storm drain was basically a round concrete bottom with, I think it had partially metal sides or basically maybe all concrete. There was a little creek that ran through there, I think called the Chabot Creek, and in the summertime it would be smaller and would be running through and making neat little sound effects inside the tunnels, and it would smell really dank in there, but generally there was some little breeze coming through so that the air wouldn't be too bad, and it would have this interesting smell that was unlike any other smell. Sometimes there would be, there might be, when there was storming, there would be, little dammed up areas with branches and stuff. And basically it was interesting, the sound, the audio effects in there were very fascinating because you could holler in there and your echo would just go for miles, it seemed like, echoing back and forth. And then occasionally you hear this thump as cars would go over the manhole covers and there would be these little thumps. And occasionally, maybe like every 100 yards or so, there would be a little up periscope tunnel that would, you know that was an area where you could climb up and determine where you were. One of the first times was I had an older friend that smoked cigarettes, and so I had my double initiation, going into the tunnel and then smoking a half a package of Newport cigarettes and throwing up. So that was kind of a strange initiation. Sometimes when we were there during the winter rains, it would be pretty precarious, and I think a number of times a couple of us maybe got washed a little ways down, but we always managed to get out because the water, if it was more than about a foot or two deep, it would basically be impossible to walk in because it was basically about an 8 foot tall by maybe 8 or 10 foot wide cylinder. And it also would change into smaller tunnels that were too precarious and too small to really be traveling in. You'd have to crawl in those. And if there was any water at all, then it would just be too dangerous and no way to keep dry. So we didn't really know where we were, but we would go a number of miles in one direction or the other. There was a cross directions too. And then there was the rats. You had to be careful because there was rats there. And if you got in a situation where you could leap across the little stream in the middle, if you were careful, and depending on the size of it. But if someone went ahead and we were split up and then came back on the other side, we would have rats between us. So then you had to be very careful because they didn't like to be cornered. So you had to just be careful. And you could hear them scampering around, their little claws like clicking on the concrete. But luckily, there wasn't any other bigger animals ever in there. So once you got within, I would say like 100 yards in, it was just a pinpoint of light at the end, and it was pitch black. And then when you got to a tunnel that went straight up, there would be a slight variation in the darkness. If you looked straight up at the point you came to the up tunnel, you could see little holes from the manhole cover as light peered on through. But other than that, it was very dark. And even though you were in there a while and your eyes would accustom to the darkness, you still couldn't see at all. In those days, we didn't have money, and it was hard to ask our parents for flashlight money. And they wanted to know what we were using our flashlights for so much. And we would like try to get candles, and then we had flares. We got flares a few times, and they would be really bizarre because they would glow with a strange orange-red glow that would change your vision. So when you came out, everything had this strange tint to it. And after the flares burn out, you would have a glowing red ember in front of you about a foot everywhere you looked. My brother was born premature, and so his optic nerve was damaged because of the oxygen mixture being too rich. And they figured this out after a number of years. Consequently, there was a whole tribe of blind people that were saved in the sense of being premature and made it through that difficult time, but consequently were left blind. It was his world in that sense because he was the master and he could run free, and we were on equal footing to a certain degree, but he had the advantage because he wasn't afraid, and he wasn't afraid, and once he learned his way, then he learned his way. But when you lose your eyesight, you have a certain fear that comes up, and that it's hard to overcome that fear, and especially running. The initiation consisted of our friends coming into the tunnel with us and us showing them how neat it was, and that we would be walking, my brother would be leading us, and that we would go slowly because generally people were pretty scared about walking without any light. And then after a half hour or so, after we were away from any sight of the entrance to the tunnel, my brother would just start running as fast as he could. And we'd leave those that were there. They didn't have the moxie or didn't have the strength to just keep following. So we would leave them for a while, and then generally come back and pick them up again. Well, some of our friends never went back in the tunnel again, and some of them laughed about it, and then I think any time that they went in again, they probably brought a flashlight. About 5 years for the time that I lived there, I think we discovered those tunnels pretty much right when we first moved to that city, and it was one of our playgrounds. We later on checked to see if it was still accessible, but it had been all changed and redeveloped so that it was all underground and there was no opening that we could ever see again. Well, it was a sense of adventure, and it was a sense of freedom, and it was a sense of maybe like getting away from our family life, which, you know, had its ups and downs, and it was a way to be totally on our own without any authority. And it also, for me, made me a stronger person and made me less afraid, because I think the dark is something that people are really afraid of. And consequently, it turned out to be something that helped me tremendously when I was in a situation in the military to where I was relying totally on those skills of traveling in those tunnels to navigate and to actually be aware and to actually make life-saving decisions. Well, my dad, being a warrior himself and a military man, he bought us a pair of 20-ounce boxing gloves, which basically are like small pillows, so no one was going to get too hurt. But we would box, and my brother is very short, and I was quite a bit taller, and he's 3 years younger, and he's blind and I'm not. So it was evident that I had to even the score a little bit, so I would put a blindfold on and box on my knees. And I showed him some moves and stuff, which later I regretted. I showed him how to throw a couple little jabs to kind of fend you off a little and then throw a right or left hook at you. And so consequently, he became quite a good boxer, boxing by sound. And he would keep his gloves up high so that he would be protected. And occasionally, I would feel like it was a little bit unfair because he had the advantage. And so a few times I lifted the blindfold slightly and connected with him, and he would be mad because he knew exactly what had happened. And we would escalate that out into all of his friends attacking me. It was, so, you know. But that escalated into something that seemed, we had slingshots. So one time we went camping, and it turned out to be a 2-day guerrilla warfare exercise where we couldn't sleep because we were afraid we'd be attacked, and we had to hide in trees. And it wasn't the best camping trip I ever went on. And finally somebody got shot in the eye. They didn't get hurt, or their eye didn't get put out. But that ended the whole thing. And I realized later it was part of our cultural kind of influence as to be warriors and trained to go off to strange lands and be needlessly killed for reasons we don't even know. So I could see this thread going through, like later on when I had this flood of memories that came through to my nocturnal training. I remember sitting silently waiting for my eyes to adapt for night vision to run point man on a combat night patrol to the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Cambodia. In Vietnam, I had some training in reconnaissance, and consequently, I was asked and volunteered for point position on patrols, which we would do in the daytime and a lot of time in the nighttime. And I thought that it was kind of an honor in a way, and then later on I realized that I was possibly being just used, and it didn't take me long to figure out that I wasn't really worth that much as cannon fodder. And so as a point man on patrol, I was able to make a decision or persuade other people to abort certain missions and make a change that from decisions that were being made that were suicidal. And I was really glad that I made those decisions, but then I was chastised for those decisions. And so I would just volunteer for more patrols to prove that I wasn't afraid. But this all led to this dichotomy of being less fearful of the dark, and therefore I was able to navigate pretty well, and and able to use my hearing, which my brother taught me how acute that your hearing can actually become and how you can use it. And that's one thing that we did in the tunnels a lot, was all you could do is hear, so your hearing would become very sensitive. One time, I traveled up the North Coast alone. I didn't have a flashlight or any way to get around, so there was a storming rain and it was at night, and I had to find my way to shelter because it was storming, and ran across some sheep that were on the hillside, and they pretty much scattered when they saw me, except for one little baby one that actually led me to a little place to where I could really hide out. And I was intuitive enough just to follow it to see where it led, and it showed me a place where there was shelter. And it turned out they had the Coast Guard and the local sheriff's department looking for me. But I ended up surviving okay and finding some food in an old abandoned dump that started me off on my health food change of diet. I found like an old package of walnuts and canned water chestnuts and wild rice. And I had some matches, so I was able to survive. So that was one of my most alone times. As far as the darkness goes, it's like, that's where we come from, it seems like, and that's where we go. And we come alone, and when we leave, we're alone. And so I think that there's something to learn about the darkness and the unknown, and that we're yet familiar with it, but we're also terrified of it.
In Sebastopol, California, you were listening to Thomas Nash. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Were you scared of the dark?
Oh, God, I was scared of the dark. Way up into my adulthood, I was scared of the dark. And I think about the point where I began to realize this is inappropriate, I'm too old for this, was when I was in high school and I finally had my driver's license and I could drive to and from high school, come home in the dark at wintertime. And it was a long distance from the garage where the car was parked out in the barn to the house. And I would absolutely every time I would say, I'm going to make it to this house walking. I am going to walk every step of the way. I never made it past halfway. I'd scream and start to run.
Yes. Well, you know, for me, it was going to sleep at night, and my eyes were shut, and I could hear very acutely the serial killer coming in through the window. I mean, there were serial killers even in Iowa that long ago. There wasn't much else to do. But actually, the dreams weren't in the dark. All my dreams were terror in full daylight. What dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. So here's one that gave me pause. It's not precisely as is, but more or less it was like this.
Here's a dream story about parking regulations in a time of crisis.
This was my dream. The first part I don't remember, but it probably had to do with packing up and going. I'm always packing up and going without ever leaving. The second part must have been driving somewhere, unless it was going to school naked, but I was old enough for a driver's license, because in the third part of the dream, I parked. I was driving our big maroon Dodge Maxi van. They always charge extra to park in parking lots, so I park on the street and walk miles. In reality, I walk miles. In dreams, I usually fly or wade waist-deep in water, but tonight I was driving. Gas prices have dropped a bit. I parked on Washington Street. I don't know what city, possibly Omaha, which does not have a Washington Street, as I recall. It was a very wide street. I thought that was appropriate to the memory of Washington. Or it might have been the Middle East, and they had named the street after Washington because democracy was breaking out. These days, I often feel close to the Middle East. There were no other cars parked there, but I wasn't worried. You can trust George Washington, or you always used to could. They talk that way in Omaha. Of course, this was a dream, and I realize now that I was applying real-life logic, and you can get in trouble with that. I had a lunch meeting. It involved selling seats, I think. At one point there was an argument over the quesadillas, and an actress broke down in tears. I knew it was an actress because she could cry. They comforted her, then ate her quesadillas. There was a circular logic here. We decided at last that we needed to sell only 40 seats. There was a feeling of triumph. After this, anything was possible, even peace in the Middle East. We were thinking about Israel and Palestine in all the wrong ways. It was all so simple, and people didn't understand because they were dying. Just 40 seats. I remember thinking then that this dream had gone on too long. My meter would be expired. If it was expired, they'd have to remove it, and then what would happen to my van? My walk to the meeting had been uphill, and the walk back was even steeper. That's how hilly it was. At that point, it was definitely San Francisco, even though it had been Omaha, because it was definitely Washington Street, even though there wasn't any Washington Street in Omaha. I thought, what if it had been San Francisco when I was a kid growing up in Omaha? My life would have been so different. Now, up to that point, this was a pretty typical dream for me. I'm a very creative person, but my dreams are those of a CPA. I never feel emotion in my dreams, even at the death of loved ones. Even when pursued by the monster, I think mainly about what it's going to cost. I came to Washington Street, and I could see from a long distance that my van wasn't there. The meter was lying melted on the sidewalk. I had been towed. I was overwhelmed with grief. I felt such weariness. It would cost so much to tow a maxi van, money I knew I'd need to fix my teeth. The next minute, my teeth would start to crumble and fall out the way they always did. How could I feel so weary when I was already asleep? And it suddenly occurred to me that if I was asleep, I could wake up. So I woke. Or I woke just enough to realize that I was awake. Dawn is a very creative time for me. I'd suddenly have an inspiration how to make lots of money, or where the pruning shears were, or how to tell my wife about the extra guppy. And the flash of insight that came to me was this. I could challenge the towing fee and the parking ticket in court on the grounds that it all happened in a dream. My mind chewed this over for what seemed like hours. At one point, I opened my eyes and saw that I'd only been dreaming it was dawn, and it was actually pitch black. I closed my eyes, and it was light again. Open, black. Reality was reversed, like being born on 9/11. Still, the logic was unassailable. I had been dreaming. I hadn't actually parked on Washington Street. There was no justification for towing me. Omaha was a democracy. I tried to compose my summation. I wouldn't need a lawyer. It was open and shut if the judge would only listen. Judges could cut you off unless you could speak Latin. And then they could fine you court costs, which no amount of insurance would cover. At that moment, I understood the tragic heart of the Middle East. It wasn't just the circular logic. It was the dilemma of opening one's eyes into blackness or seeing the judge only through eyes sealed shut. Different realities, like the experiment with photons that killed some German's cat. How could the judge hear me if we were never in the same courtroom? How would the killing stop? I gave it all up. I wrote out a check for a very large amount. I didn't know what the fine would be, I could only guess. I felt my teeth begin to craze. Then suddenly the alarm rang, and I woke. As completely as I ever do. It's been a number of days now. I continue to be troubled by this dream. Not the symbolism so much. I think cars mean vacations or sperm, but I don't know about vans. What plagues me is that I can't recall if I mailed the check. Of course, I know it was only a dream. I never parked on Washington Street. I was never towed. I haven't been in Omaha for years. It makes no sense even to consider mailing a check. And if it does symbolize sperm, so what? I'm a normal, healthy male. Yet that check floats in limbo. A sultry, overcast limbo. Will my phantom check appease the phantom judge? I imagine him flickering across the banks of soundless TVs in a sports bar on Polk Street. How very far we've gone from Washington to Polk. Are my eyes open now to daytime or to dream? Will we ever fathom the tragic heart of the Middle East? Is it up to me to dream the killing stopped?
You were listening to Conrad Bishop. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. Thank you.